Okay, we're going to open up the phone lines now, give you an opportunity to chat with our guest, Charles Pellegrino. I've got to ask him still about this new thing he's working on, this library in Egypt. That's kind of fascinating. See if we can squeeze some information out of him. We'll be back. Charles, can you say anything about this Egyptian library that you were talking about?
Very little. It's one of those projects that's actually being filmed as the work goes on. As we work, it is now being filmed for a documentary, a rather major one. But it's just that, you know, really cannot talk too much about these things until it's all analyzed and the scientific papers are published. Also working... flying back and forth with the History Channel, filming work that's going on at Herculaneum, another place where we also have a library. And the technology is available now that with a simple Photoshop program, all these burned scrolls can actually be read very easily these days. Just using infrared and a Photoshop program, we can distinguish between carbonized paper and carbonized ink. Very interesting times. We've got another, we've got part of a library where we now have for the first time, and in fact, all of this is now being filmed by the History Channel, the Herculaneum Project, for example. In fact, in all of Ghost of Vesuvius, the entire book is being filmed for a feature on the History Channel.
Ah, okay.
But we've got, for example, now a complete copy, the first complete copy of the Acts of Philip. Of St. Philip, one of the apostles, and the journeys of his sister with him and his sister Mary. And it's a fascinating, fascinating, actually beautiful story about Philip, who is one of the hothead apostles, and his two steps forward, one step back, until finally he goes to greater and greater levels of humanity. The interesting thing is, we read about how in Greece he is known as the man who freed the slaves. And we did not have this copy. We did not have this information when I was working on, for example, the case of Justa of Herculaneum. And talk about a shock cocoon. We not only had part of a library there that was shock cocooned, but somehow thermally cocooned. Most of the court records in this house that we now recognize as a house of very early first century Christians who were, in fact, among the wealthiest people in town, they were taking and supporting the case of a young 17-year-old slave girl, or someone who a family was trying to force into slavery somewhat as a real-life Cinderella case. And again, this was Christians taking up the case basically as abolitionist and trying to help get this girl freed through the courts. It was almost a servile revolt through the courts of Rome, a case that had actually taken the interest of Emperor Titus himself. So we're getting an interesting view of these early first century Christians not only being very wealthy, but also being involved in an abolitionist movement in more than one case now. So it also gets rather interesting how human nature is that 1,500 years later, descendants of that emerging religion would be twisting the words in their own Bible to become part of the slave trade. And then another swerve of history where in America it was... Quakers, who were another branch of an evolving Christianity that ended up having much to do with the Underground Railroad and an abolitionist movement against slavery in America. So just very interesting swerves of history that we're always coming upon.
I wonder if we can get you to go look even for the Hall of Records that Edgar Casey said was at the foot of the Sphinx. That'd be a great mystery, huh?
I'm not sure any such Hall of Records exists under the foot of the Sphinx. It's just that Halls of Records really are showing up now in different parts of the world. And very, very fascinating records, giving us views of civilization that we never, ever had before.
Let's go to some phones. We'll pick it up, first of all, by going east of the Rockies. Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is John calling from Lima, Ohio.
Hi, John. Go ahead.
How you both doing?
Good. Thank you.
Had a question in the thoughts of Herculaneum and Pompeii. Well, what does Charles believe happened at Sodom and Gomorrah? What's the evidence seem to show happened?
Well, there is a city that fits the description of Sodom and Gomorrah, the biblical descriptions, roughly about 1900 B.C., and that is in Iraq. Not anywhere near the River Jordan, and it's a site called Mashkan Shapir. And about a third of the city burned to a crisp, evidently after an earthquake that brought an eruption of natural gas into the city. And of course, with cooking hearths in every direction, this was bound to ignite somewhat like a miniature, you know, like a major scale air fuel bomb or a miniature atomic bomb. And the bones of the animals, everything was baked and preserved. And the name of the king that built the city, Sid Adidim, it's a name that goes back to some of the original Hebrew. There are many things that match this. Of course, I said, well, isn't this in the wrong location? And a Jesuit scholar showed me, Charlie, you're going the wrong way. You have to go back to the original Hebrew in the language of the tribes people who actually wrote this. And then you see that the Sea of Reeds moves around and that these locations are kind of fluid in exactly where places were when you get back to stories that date back about 4,000 years ago. And then you look at it and you also see that the other cities named around Sodom and Gomorrah are also cities in what, you know, we call Babylon, ancient Babylon, or what is today Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I'm going to follow up on that.
Okay, thanks. Did you ever see any past history or evidence, Charles, of any nuclear holocaust on this planet? In the old days now, ancient.
No, nothing like that. There is plenty of evidence of Holocaust on this planet, and the more you look at that, the more you realize that, yes, there is some legitimate concern about asteroids striking the planet, but when you look at the history of life and the history of civilization, you begin to get much more concerned about the dangers that lie directly underfoot.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Volcanic activity is really what does the most harm. Although when we get an asteroid, it really makes up for an awful lot of volcanoes.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Where are you calling from?
Hi, George. This is Michael. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi, Charles. Pleasure speaking with you, too, tonight. I just wanted to call and comment. George, I wanted to talk to you on facts about 9/11. You're on your show, you know. You,
mm-hmm.
I discovered your show post 9/11, and it's been a godsend. And I've always had stuff to contribute on many of your topics. And I wanted to contribute tonight on the shock of the cocoon.
Sure.
I wasn't there that day, but I worked on the 95th floor of Tower 1.
Oh my!
And of course, a bunch of my friends did, and including my best friend. They were at work. They had gone in early, and the plane, if you look at the NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology report, they show the photograph. The plane pretty much just came and hit our floors. We had floors 95 to 100, and the plane pretty much came, like, pretty much right through where I sat. But my friend and my other friends on the floor, there were 11 of them that, believe it or not, managed to survive. The initial impact, of course, they were stuck in the northwest corner. We had two-way pagers. I was talking with my best friend who was stuck up there, and another coworker, a good friend of mine, was talking to another one of our good friends who was stuck there with him. And just to imagine that plane came through our floors and just blew it out, yet those 11 people were able to stand there on that floor for almost an hour before he said goodbye to me.
Oh, my God. What did he describe, Michael, that as? I mean, did he see the plane coming?
They had no, he did not see it coming. None of them saw it coming. They actually had no idea. I asked him in our conversation, where did the plane hit? And he had no idea. And I had to tell him that a terrorist were attacking the buildings with planes.
Did he hear something? Obvious.
Oh, yes. They just heard a loud, horrible crash. And I've had coworkers who weren't up in our floors, who only a few of them actually, who were below the floors, and managed to get out miraculously. And the stories of how the building lurched. I mean, you're imagining a story where each floor is about it's almost an acre each floor. And this mammoth building, which barely creaked in the wind, it just didn't even sway. It lurched, and people went flying. But he was telling me a little bit of the details. My other friend was also, she was paging down to another coworker, and she was giving greater details about the horror that was going on up there. But they had no idea it was a plane. They just thought it was a humongous explosion.
Just one explosion, or did they hear more than that?
It was, they didn't really have time to get into too much detail. The nature of my friend's conversation was a little bit more graphic as to what was going on at that moment.
Oh, yeah.
And how they were pinned, and they just couldn't get anywhere near a staircase.
And he talked to you, Michael, up to the moment he died?
Pretty much, yeah. He spoke to me for about an hour, and they were pinned in the corner. The plane came through where our data center was, and the fire just, like, the floor below them. I mean, you could almost imagine, as you've probably seen in cartoons, where people are pinned and the fire is just eating
just
out the floor.
Just kept coming closer and closer.
And then finally, he just, he knew that it was it. And,
how did he say bye? I mean, oh my God!
His last words were "fire here, love you," and that was it.
And he just stopped talking.
And he just stopped talking. About the same time,
why weren't you at work,
George? I hated going to work there ever since my company announced we were moving there. The moment they announced we were moving there, I stood up after the meeting. I said, "Why don't they just paint targets on us? We're gonna get killed." I hated working there. My friend who died told me, you can't be that way. Don't think that way.
You were uncomfortable.
I was very uncomfortable. So I tend to drag my feet and show up late. And as it was, I was waiting for my mother-in-law to come and babysit my son that morning. So I was kind of dragging my feet.
Oh, my.
My best friend, I told him many, many times, why are you, because he would stay late and get in early. I said, why are you doing this? It's not worth it.
You wanted to get in late and get out early and just get out of that building. Huh?
And I even said just about every other week, because I used to commute back and forth on the weekends between New Jersey, and I lived in Queens at the time. So we used to go to the promenade along the BQE, and you would see the whole skyline. And coming back from New Jersey Sunday night, I would say to my wife, my then wife, oh, the buildings are still there. I guess I'm going to work on Monday. And this went on for, I just knew.
You felt this impending doom?
Oh, I knew it. I knew it. And I used to say to him, you have a family at home. You have a new baby at home. He had made me the godfather of his son just a few weeks before this all happened.
Now, when you say you knew it, what do you mean by you knew it? I mean, what did you feel?
I felt that they were going to definitely attack us again. I think that part of it was logic, that they were just not going to. I think you'd have to be an idiot to think that they were going to let that failed attempt go. Mm-hmm. These people are insane. Of course, as it would be, I worked for a risk management company, an insurance company, so go figure their decision to move into the building. But I just knew it was just bad news, and I spoke to him so many times. It's not worth dying for this company. They don't care. Your blood is not, it's not worth your blood. Be with your family, put in your hours, and leave.
We've got a special program on that on Thursday. You might want to call in on that one.
I would love to, and I would also love to tell you how the day before, our buildings were being circled by black helicopters, unmarked black helicopters. A friend of mine worked.
Well, now, was that unusual?
Very unusual. You never saw helicopters circling the buildings, never. And my friend that I knew from a previous job, she managed to work in a law firm that was below the crash site. And the partner of our firm called the FBI because there were these strange black helicopters circling the building.
Well, I've got to ask you this only because you're on the air here with us. Do you think there was anything strange here beyond what the official report has been?
Absolutely.
You do?
Absolutely. Without a doubt. And I mean, I've done, as you can imagine, lots of research. I listen to your show because most of the nights, my nights are plagued with nightmares and I'm up.
I don't blame you.
And so I've done a lot of research. I've looked into a lot of things, and I've heard tons of stories that corroborate with your guests on your show. Without a doubt, they knew this was going to happen. Whether or not they wanted it to happen to have a reason to go to war, or they just didn't see any way of stopping it, I really can't say. I wouldn't be surprised either way, though.
All right, make sure you're part of the program Thursday.
Yes, if your producer would like, I would love to partake in it because I have plenty to say on
Very good. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Pretty fascinating person there, Charles.
Yeah. I don't know about the conspiracy theories about government knowing it's going to happen. The same sorts of things arose after the Pearl Harbor bombing that the government knew it was going to happen and wanted it to happen. And, you know, I guess people will look at what the evidence is and it'll all sort out. And 40, 50 years from now, history will sort it out and have its say. People on the 95th floor shock cocooned. With the North Tower, shock cocoons have kind of been my nightmare. My cousin Donna was right where the starboard wing of Flight 11 hit on the 98th floor. And I've reviewed all that footage and seen the blast wave and just, okay, you know, if it was over within 1/2000th of a second, that always brings me some comfort. And now hearing that just in an even more hard-hit zone, there were
survivors
for a while, just right down below her.
Trapped without floors.
Because I cling just kind of hoping it really was instant. And there was, I know no cell phones got out from Donna's office. Where the starboard wing was really actually acting almost as, basically the barrel of a cannon for outlet of all that pressure. So probably it really was very fast. There was the only cell phone call we have from that area was a woman in my cousin's office who was on the phone at the moment of impact.
Well, I tell you.
And her husband heard the sudden whine, very loud whine, Doppler whine of the engine coming in, and his wife had time enough to get at the words, "Oh my," and it was over. And that's really the way I hope it was.
Let's come back to you in a moment. We'll take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And tomorrow's program will originate from the cave in St. Louis, and our guest will be Mark Lerner. He's going to talk about scientific and cosmic forces that affect world events. And our Friday program will originate out of Detroit, so I'm going to be bouncing around the globe for a while. But I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Charles, I used to work with a sportscaster in Detroit years ago. His name was Joe Pellegrino. Any relationship?
Somewhere along the line, probably. I just don't. In what city?
Detroit.
No, I don't know the Detroit Pellegrinos, but evidently we all are all related and go back, interestingly, to the Naples area.
Interesting.
Near Vesuvius.
Isn't that fitting? I wonder if you believe in reincarnation, if you might have been out there.
No, I tend not to believe in reincarnation, although as far as philosophy or religion, I guess I'm closest to being a Buddhist. So.
Tell me the story again before we go back to calls about those fireflies on May 30th, 2002.
Yeah. Well, there was a similar incident actually last year on the
Really? Okay.
Anniversary, the third anniversary of 9/11. with the lights. Now, I live in New York City most of the time, and I've only seen something like this once. It's not a very common occurrence with lights at the Empire State Building that had attracted a lot of birds and insects. But the twin lights last year, they went up, and as I approached, I have over an hour of video footage of this. Everyone was rather taken aback by this. And at any one moment doing the plankton count technique, there were about 3,000 of them. And these moths and other insects, plus a few bats and birds, were whirling around in the lights. It was actually a very peaceful scene. It was all happening in utter silence, that at any one second there were about 3,000 of these objects that were blazing forth, reflecting the light, and they looked like brilliant sparks within the twin beams of the twin towers that were, you know, just shining miles up into the sky. There's been an incident every year. In 2002, a very, very sunny day, and just like the day the attacks took place, and as the names were being read off, this angry, you know, they read the names of the people who died at Ground Zero, and out of nowhere, this terrific wind came, just whirling up the dust, and you just had a feeling looking at it, and I also happened to have this on video, just looking down from 20 floors up at the family room in One Liberty Plaza, just this sense that it was an angry, angry wind. And out of this calm day had come this wind. It's just at one point the whole crater of Ground Zero is just this intense fog of sheets of shifting dust at very rapid speed. And you know, I was there was also the incident on the anniversary in 2003 was a bit more personal. I again, something that one actually being the thing that is a bit more beyond coincidence. You can explain the coincidence of the wind. You can explain, okay, the lights attracted the insects, and of course it happened on the anniversary. But you know, you can still ascribe that to coincidence. On 9/11/2003. I was, before I went into the crater with firefighter Pat Brown's girlfriend, he had died on the 44th floor. In fact, it was his words when he was told, don't go up there. And he said, we've got a job to do. And those words are what kept me going, kept me stiff in my spine on the days when, during the forensic archaeology phase of the whole thing, I kind of just wanted to walk away on certain days. And you know, it's just immediately, no, Patty Brown, we've got a job to do, and just, you know, do your job.
We've got a picture, by the way, if people want to go to the coasttocoastam.com website, from 9/11/04 of those twin light beams, and you can see what are moths, for example, thousands of them up there. And not that that would be unusual, but it is strange.
John Morabito, firefighter, shock cocoon survivor at Ten House, which is the firehouse right on the edge of the crater. He was talking with, we were talking about this last week and about Patty Brown and what happened in 2003. And he said he's wondering what will be the event for 2005,
good
what
point.
Happens there, what strange thing. He says, because in 2003, before we went down into the crater, I was, not many people know this, I was getting a pretty tough beating over Chapter 10 of Ghost of Vesuvius. My own editor was pressuring me to remove the Vindication of Four Crew from the book.
Why?
Because people were so mad. The people behind, the within the publishing industry, I never imagined, and I wish I didn't know now what I didn't know before all this about some of the things that go on in the publishing industry. There were a number of people who circle their wagons around the people who were behind the ladder four hoax.
I see.
And to make a long story short, I took a really bad beating. At the time, I was recalling the words of Cy Unger, a friend who had survived Auschwitz, and he said, even though we all knew in the 1930s that we did nothing wrong, we did nothing to deserve this, when you're called a bad dog enough, he said, every one of us, as we approached the gates of Auschwitz, we had a sense of somehow we must have done something to deserve this. And I said to Alinda before we went down into the crater, and as we picked up the roses for our loved ones who didn't make it out of there, I said, is there any chance, whatsoever that these people, you know, the hoaxers, could be right? And that I'm the one who's wrong, you know, that I've missed something with my science, that maybe they're right. And I don't have the words to describe what happened right now. It was way beyond coincidence that I can calculate. It was you know, another of those things that happened twice. It was chance of one in millions. It involved Ladder 4. We can talk about it another time, but when we came up from the crater, with the firefighters later, Linda turned to me and she said, you know, Patty just tapped you on the shoulder. He's watching out for his friends. That's why you were there on Liberty Street. He's watching out for his friends of Four Truck. And she said to me, Charlie, don't you ever doubt yourself again.
I love it.
you know, it's a story probably for another time. It's if there's any, I don't fully believe, but I really don't half doubt that there have been other incidents that this one firefighter who I never met while he was alive, there have been several incidents where I've almost felt his presence and almost literally, you wonder, maybe your kind of subconscious mind picks up something that's about to happen, something you have to do, and if you don't do this at this moment, you're on the wrong track and you're really going to regret it. And in one case, almost physically being shoved off my feet from behind, it was like, oh, Patty Brown, who was a bit of a nut job and a jokester during life. And but, you know, in the back of my mind, a feeling that, yeah, maybe this guy has become this family's guardian angel. It sometimes feels that way, but as a scientist, I'll tell you, I carry a lot of, I'm a Doubting Thomas. Doubting Thomas, that's me.
All right, let's go finish up with calls here. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello. Fascinating. I'm all choked up from his stories. I had a question for your guest and a comment for you, George.
Sure.
I did try to get through earlier when with the Bigfoot thing, and I'll take about 30 seconds after my question to tell you what I saw through a remote viewing. The question for your guest, I'm astounded with his knowledge of so many things. It's mind-boggling. With the DNA research that they've done recently, you know, with the cloning of sheep and things in the Orient, the woolly mammoth that was found years ago, almost perfectly preserved, hair, muscle tissue, and all that. Is there any way that these cryptozoologists could take the DNA cloning methodologies found recently and apply those to, transferring some of the DNA, like you were saying with the dinosaur things, transferring, say, a woolly mammoth's DNA to the, modern-day elephant egg?
I think they want to do that.
Actually, there are people who are actually looking at that and working out ways to do it. And in the very least, here the important part is, once we can read the woolly mammoth genome and get a complete genome, you may be able to bring viable DNA from woolly mammoth cells and stitch it in, or you may even be able to modify elephant DNA to do the same job once you can read woolly mammoth DNA and have the complete code. There are people looking at that. I'm not part of that project and never will be. As I said, what interests me is the same technology that can do that, and if it can be done, people will do it. the same technology can be used to cure illness, to treat all sorts of diseases, to look at other sorts of things that are on the genetic frontier, such as anti-aging, even possibly artificially boosting the human IQ. Oh, won't that make things more, maybe even more bad. But great criminal geniuses. But, you know, each new advance we have carries new responsibilities. I mean, from the time we had fire, you could cook foods, you could make foods accessible that were inaccessible before, and you could also burn down your neighbor's house. And, you know, hopefully as one thing that archaeology teaches me and that history teaches me is that, yes, we have a very, very long way to go. But the more I look back, even over the last 100 years, we have already come a very long way as a people who are becoming gradually more humane. We have gotten better. You would not, none of us would want to go back to the time of the Titanic and live in a time when it was perfectly socially acceptable for a bishop at St. Patrick's Cathedral to write an editorial in the Brooklyn Daily Eagle about how the Titanic was struck down by God because there was an interracial couple on the ship making mulatto children. And at the same time, you had some Spanish man lynched by a mob out on Long Island because he said something wrong to a white woman. But the words used were, he was duly hanged, almost as if, you know, in the proper order of things, he was hanged.
Thank God things have changed.
We have come a long way. We've, along the way, needed some shock therapy for civilization to show us how bad we can really get, such as Nazi Germany and Pol Pot and so on. And, you know, maybe those are some of the things that are nudging us in a more right direction, that we have these warning signs, these giant billboards of how bad we can really get, and that we better not step in that direction again.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Ryan in Orlando.
Hi, Ryan. Go ahead.
I have a comment and then a question. George, when you said earlier, you know, all the order that has to exist for life to exist, maybe the way to look at it is the reason all that order is there is because life creates that order. But getting to my question, I just wanted to ask, is there anything about the Titanic that would that you see as a big, you know, something that most people wouldn't know about the sinking of the Titanic, or something that happened that hasn't really been in the movies or the documentaries that you would think that most people wouldn't know?
Well, interesting, the breakaway of the Grand Stairway and how much that might have had an effect on which way smokestacks fell. We're really getting down into details like that. We've still not resolved completely the significance of the coal fire that was going out there. And boy, that was an improbable event. You had a coal fire in a coal bunker that happened to be the junction at where Watertight Compartment was. And we have the surviving crew who reported in the British and American Inquiry how the base of that bunker was warped and so on. And then you have this highly improbable event of the ship going into an ice field and no one seeing an iceberg go by the side, by the port side, by the starboard side and say, oh, we're in an ice field, let's slow down. No, the first iceberg they see is dead center in front of the nose of the ship, only about 300 or 400 feet away when they see it. And the last 2 or 3 feet of iceberg damage along the starboard side end up kicking against that fire-weakened bulkhead that is going to be called on to act as the dam that decides, that is the deciding point on whether or not the ship floats or sinks. Just incredible, one in several billion odds of things working out the way they worked with the Titanic. And literally the distance between life and death being a few inches. It's just no ship has sunk that way in precisely that way against such probabilities before or since.
Oh, very interesting. All right, thanks a lot.
Okay, appreciate you being on the program. Last call, first time caller line. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, This is Anthony from Gainesville, Florida.
Go ahead, Anthony.
I'm getting a real kick out of your science. Your science is great. But you had to bring up the design factor and the religious factor, and I've got one for you that I have never gotten a good answer from any scientist. It has to do with three laws of thermodynamics. Any scientist knows them. And, of course, there's the one that says that all systems tend to become more complex. And as far as I'm concerned, that demonstrates the existence of God. It's just a question of time. I tell people that, and they say, well, you mean there's going to be God in the future? And I go, well, it's a question of time. How old is the universe?
Well, okay, things really don't...
And 1 minute to go, Charles.
Oh.
Go ahead, 1 minute to go.
Okay. Things normally don't really run down constantly into greater states of disorder. It's the laws of thermodynamics are kind of used not quite properly in these arguments. And if you just go by those strict mathematics, you can prove anything. Mathematics only occasionally really describe reality. Zeno's paradox. I can prove to you that... motion is impossible, because if you stand a foot away with your nose a foot away from a wall and have it, you're getting involved in mathematical infinity and you can never really touch that wall. It's impossible. Just looking at mathematical infinity, it's an illusion. It's a mathematical abstraction that really doesn't have any bearing on life in the same way as absolute infinity, as, for example, when a photon reaches the speed of light. Now, that is where you reach all sorts of crazy contradictions, which could be a whole other show.
That is absolutely true. Charles, thank you so much for being on the program. Appreciate it. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. That'll be out of St. Louis. Be safe, everyone.